Suicide Squad is now in theaters, and we are just getting started here on post-show recaps. Hello, everyone. Mike Bloom here talking about yet another summer film in this cavalcade of movies that is 2016. There's been a lot of superhero movies going on. They've run the gamut. Some have been great, some not so great. Here we're going to talk about yet another superhero film, Suicide Squad, another installment of the DC Extended Universe, which just came out in theaters. But of course, in true Suicide Squad style, I am not alone. I am joined by a motley crew of other podcasters here on Post Show Recaps. First, you may know him from his coverage on Post Show Recaps of Jessica Jones, Daredevil, and talking about many other superhero movies, including Batman vs. Superman, which I'm assuming will be referenced many, many times. And his takes are, much like Deadshot, rare to miss. It is the one and only Kevin Mahadeo. Kevin, how you doing?
Hey, everyone. I'm doing all right over here on the sunny West Coast.
Well, it's sunny on the East Coast as well. It is definitely not like the latter half of Suicide Squad. There is much light to be found across the country as we're talking.
No giant darkness with beams in the sky or anything?
No, I'll have to check if there's a circle of random light circling around the Empire State Building. But having just seen Ghostbusters a few weeks ago, it seems run of the course for this summer. We are also joined by a guy who you may know from his coverage of Fear the Walking Dead, Game of Thrones fandom, but he has been watching so much Big Brother this summer that he might get a tattoo of damaged on his forehead. It's one and only Alex Kidwell. Alex, how you doing?
Hey, I'm doing good. Yeah, I feel like if Kevin is our Deadshot, then I'm very much like the Captain Boomerang, where as far as comics and superheroes go, you might be wondering, like, what is that guy doing here? What is he really bringing to the table? And you'd probably be right to do so.
Is there going to be a segment where I say, like, okay, guys, you don't need to stay here, and you're just going to be the first one to jet out?
Yeah, but expect me to come back 5 minutes later unexpectedly and not really explain why.
Yeah, yeah. Right. I will admit early on, though, I actually love that scene, and we can digest it a little bit more later, but I did love that little bit.
Yeah, so let's not get into too much spoiler stuff, because much like other installments of the DC Universe, Suicide Squad has come both pre, during, and post-filming with its own slew of talking points and miniature controversies to talk about. But first, I mean, I know I personally am not a big comic book guy. I am definitely much more of a movie fan than a comic book fan when it comes to my superhero fandom. But that being said, much like the other installments of the DC Universe, I know that Suicide Squad is something that has existed in comic book form beforehand. Kevin, as our resident comic book expert, can you just give myself and the audience a little bit of an introduction as to who the Suicide Squad are in the comic books and how they may relate to what we saw on screen?
Yeah, there's been, you know, a few iterations as time has gone on. They've been around for a little while. Originally, in the way back olden days, it was a completely unrelated group that were sort of good guys. But then really the Suicide Squad we know came about by John Ostrander, and basically the idea is kind of what we see. Amanda Waller forms this team of villains to do covert missions. Deadshot is almost a staple, I feel like, throughout the entire Suicide Squad's existence, which actually I should say they are actually called Task Force X, which is a fun tidbit. Yeah, the actual name of the group was originally Task Force X, but they were nicknamed the Suicide Squad, which, you know, Will Smith as Deadshot kind of alluded to as the in the trailers you've seen, actually. So, yeah, they're the group of villains. A lot of them come in and out throughout comic history. There's different incarnations. The most recent one features Harley Quinn, as does the movie. In fact, the most recent rebirth of DC Comics actually features a team that's very strikingly similar to the one we saw in this movie, almost as if it was done on purpose.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's actually really interesting if you look at it, which is smart in my opinion, because you really do want to line up. If the audience responds really well to this, you want them to be able to look at a comic book and see the team they just saw in a way. So yeah. It's very cleverly done, which is hilariously so a lot of comic book companies don't do. They don't actually line up pretty well with the movies. But they're not your typical good guy. They're bad guys doing, I don't even want to say good things. They're doing things to accomplish missions that are kind of sketchy, and you get the bad guys to do it. They're forced to do it because they have bombs implanted in their neck, and basically it's like, you do this because you have to, but you'll also get reduced prison sentence. But for some of them, their prison sentences are like you know, three life sentences, so X years off is not going to do real much for them. But yeah, that's kind of the quick nitty-gritty rundown of the Suicide Squad. Mm-hmm. And in that regard, I think the the movie kind of nailed exactly what they're in concept supposed to be. So yeah.
I do want to ask, does the Suicide Squad in the comic books, are they also working towards the incentive of time off their prison sentences? Because if they're that ingrained and they're going through multiple appearances, wouldn't it make sense if they were working towards something higher than just some time off, as you said, possible triple life sentences?
Yeah, I mean, really, it's to try and get time off, but also because they have the bombs in their neck, they're sort of forced to do it. It's like, it's the worst situation for them. Half of them don't want to do it, but are like, well, if you don't participate, we'll just blow your head off. And of course, yeah. Plausible deniability, they're villains, something happened, you know? So it's almost like they're forced to do it with the quote-unquote benefit of getting time off. And smaller benefits, too, for some of them, you know, like, oh, you get to visit your daughter, for example, or something. They'll sneak in some stuff. It also allows them to not be cooped up all day long in a prison, you know? So being able to go out into the world is almost incentive for some, because it's like, hey, you guys are villains. You like murdering people. How about we let you go do that? And so, you know, for some people, it's like, yeah, I'm bored. I'm going to go shoot people, I guess.
Yeah, it's like extra recess, essentially. Yeah. It's like, hey, here's a bigger playing field for you to carry out the actions that you've previously been incarcerated for under our guidance. Alex, I know you've been tweeting about this movie in relation to the animated version of the Suicide Squad. Tell us a little bit about that. When did it come out, and how does it relate to this movie, if at all?
Cool. Yeah. So this was released by DC Animated Films a couple years ago, 2014. It's called Batman Assault on Arkham, and it's really easy to find. And I think it's a really good iteration in terms of what the Suicide Squad is kind of designed for in concept. You know, this is a group that you don't necessarily need for you know, to save the day, so to speak. You kind of use them when you don't want people to know you're doing stuff. They're kind of off the books because, I mean, look at them. They're a group of criminals. You're using them to accomplish kind of government operations. So I think Batman Assault on Arkham is, you know, it's not to get into it too deeply, but it's a situation where basically they're tasked with breaking into Arkham Asylum, which is, you know, clearly not something that you would, you know, get Batman or someone to do. So it's a bit different from what we see ultimately here, which is the Suicide Squad kind of playing more of a role in kind of a bigger, almost world-saving situation by the end of everything.
So before we really jump into the nitty-gritty and discussion about the movie proper, I do kind of want to put ourselves in the brains of the three of us, I'd say up to a week ago, when after the rather contentious release of Batman versus Superman, there was a lot of news that was going around about Suicide Squad. And I want to get from you guys, what was your opinion leading up to this film, either before Batman versus Superman was released, afterwards, before you heard all this news about the reshoots and all that stuff? Alex, I'll lay it out. Were you excited for this film, even amidst all the other controversies that the DC Universe was getting in the past few months?
Yes, but hesitantly. You know, I haven't really been too public about it. I haven't, you know, recorded anything about it, but I wasn't the biggest fan of Batman versus Superman. I thought it wasn't a particularly well put together film. I thought a lot of things didn't really make sense. So I was coming into Suicide Squad with the knowledge of what the source material was. I think one thing that's really cool about Suicide Squad, the concept, is how it really relates to things today in the sense of just this omnipresent element of Amanda Waller, who's played by Viola Davis, and I think she's really good in the film. That's one, you know, one role, and I think Will Smith is Deadshot too. There's a couple roles that are really spot on, I think, for me. But, you know, she's someone that's always watching and always kind of monitoring everything they're doing. So these are criminals that are, yes, they're out on the loose, but they're also kind of dealing with this omnipresent government element that can explode their brains at any time, which makes them sympathetic. And you begin to understand kind of their position in a way that you never could when they're just plain antagonists fighting the heroes like they are in so many stories. So I think Suicide Squad is so cool in that way. And it really has a very legitimate place in contemporary storytelling if done correctly. And so I was really, really excited for this movie, although my expectations were definitely tempered coming in because I wasn't the biggest fan of BVS.
Now, Kevin, you have made your opinion very well known in post-show recaps, previous podcasts about BVS.
Yeah, my thoughts on BVS are pretty out there to the public. It's a couple of people have heard it. If you haven't, go back and listen to the BVS podcast. Obviously coming out of BVS, for me, it was like two strikes already, right? Like, because I wasn't a big fan of Man of Steel. I wasn't a big fan of BVS. And so we have this next movie coming up, Suicide Squad. And my heart, my deepest heart wanted to be like, okay, you have to be the one. You have to be the chosen one.
Now is your heart residing in a metallic case next to you while you're having these thoughts?
Yes, I have it in a suitcase, kept safe, away from especially people like Josh Wigler, who might use that to his advantage. it's just, you know, I wanted it to be good, and you know, we can talk more about it as it goes. I feel like this is a movie that could have been, but it's weird because I'm obviously very entrenched in the marketing, in the commercials and everything, right? Like I pay attention mm-hmm. to a lot of that stuff. So I immediately almost had bizarre red flags because the very, very first Suicide Squad trailer was like that muted tone, a much more like kind of like darker trailer. There was like the logo was metallic, like pure metallic. There was no color to it. And then BVS happened, and then Deadpool happened, and it's like obviously the American public or the movie going public was just kind of like, oh, we like this fun stuff, you know? And all of a sudden all the marketing for Suicide Squad changed. It became just a rainbow of things. And so for me, it was just a weird thing. Cause I'm like, oh, that's weird where you have to change what you're trying to present your movie as, you know? So I already kind of had like hesitation because of that. I felt like, oh gosh, they're trying to tell me it's funny. When it first started, they weren't selling the funny bits. So I felt like already going in, I was like, oh no, this is not going to be what they're trying to sell me. And in a way it wasn't. So yeah, I tempered feelings going in just because of I should just cut off myself from that stuff. And maybe I wouldn't have these type of opinions going in.
It's tough to cut yourself off from really anything in the world today, especially when you're probably so entrenched in the comic book world, you can't really say, well, you know what? I'm just not going to pay attention to any sort of thing that's going on from this major distributor about this major clan of superheroes.
Yeah, and I think a big element is, too, this was the on-screen debut, can't really be understated, the on-screen debut of Harley Quinn, who's become, in the last, you know, decade plus, a major figure in DC Comics, and really in cosplaying, especially.
Yeah, I believe she premiered in, what, Batman the Animated Series back in, like, the late 90s, early 2000s, and then from there she kind of just caught on as a fan favorite. So I'll say, I'll sort of go along with Alex and sort of share my very brief opinions on Batman versus Superman as well. I was not a big fan either. I think, you know, as someone who enjoys things that are probably a little more lighthearted, I did find it very glum, a little bit of a droll. Jesse Eisenberg, God bless his heart, one of my celebrity doppelgangers, was one Jolly Rancher away from getting sent down to one of Willy Wonka's furnaces and being turned into some sort of candy by the end of it. Going out of it, I do agree with what you guys were saying. I was very cautious about this film, especially as Kevin just talked about. I feel like the pivot in marketing was exciting, but at the same time, a little bit showing its cards in a way where the company was saying like, hey, you know what? You want something better? Let's go back and retool this already made product to fit your wishes. And I feel like it's great when studios listen to their audiences, but when you're trying to do that with an already created product, you know, it's sort of like, I don't know, dressing up a pig and pretending to like take it to the prom of like, listen, you know what? You can comb that hair and put it in the biggest suit that you want to. At the end of the day, it's still going to be a pig that rolls around in the mud. There's really not much you can change within the internal structure of it. But I was liking the trailers. I mean, I'll admit, as a big like classic rock fan, having the trailer timed out to Bohemian Rhapsody, I thought was cool, and it definitely got me sufficiently pumped to see the movie. But like Alex said, I definitely kept my wits about me, knowing that DC had just 5 months prior released a movie that was considered to be very disappointing and did not live up to expectations. As Rob Cesternino, who I would call the Amanda Waller of post-show recaps, would say, lowered expectations are the key to happiness. And I definitely tried to keep that in mind while seeing this film.
Yeah, it definitely, I will say, I mean, I went in with lowered expectations, which was a good thing, because I think having high hopes, especially, it sounds bad, but sometimes in the DC movies, having too high hopes can be devastating. Even with the lowered expectations, we can, you know, when we get into it, I feel like still didn't need to be what it needed to be.
Yeah, and I definitely went in trying to tell myself, I think, that, you know, enjoy this for what it is, just whatever you do, just, you know, kind of enjoy it. And I think it's definitely true. Like, it can't be understated that I've always been a much bigger fan of DC than Marvel. I mean, my whole life. And I think I've gone into Marvel movies with low expectations by default. And I'd be lying if I said I didn't think that was probably a factor here, that I just want mm-hmm. so badly for these DC movies to be masterpieces, because I see what they do in the graphic novels and I see what they do in actually a lot of these animated films that have been coming out lately have been fantastic. And so it's encouraging when you see signs and you wonder, like, ooh, if you could just adapt this to the screen. But
yeah,
there are then, you know, the BVSs and the Man of Steels where you're like, this isn't the same.
And I will say something that really excited me about Suicide Squad as well, outside of the marketing pivot, was just the idea of it. I mean, I'll admit that probably my favorite part of the DC universe are the Rogues Gallery from Batman. I almost feel like the writers and creators often have the most fun with them because they're a little more over the top. You don't try to portray them as grim and serious. They can be, I mean, there's literally a figure in the Batman Rogues Gallery whose main concept is he asks questions and riddles. Like, that sounds ridiculous if you say it in any sort of other fictional world, but here it totally makes sense. And I always have had the most fun with it, even amidst the Joel Schumacher films of the late 90s. I still had fun with the Rogues Gallery of Batman villains. So I know these guys are probably more Rogues Gallery adjacent, and you guys can probably correct me on that. But the idea of having these villains and bad people come together and try to work together for a good end goal was at least a concept that I was excited going in with. I feel like it was going to be fun no matter what. But that being said, I'm going to stop the non-spoilery talk here. So if you guys have not seen the movie yet, or if you care about being spoiled, I would ask, bail out of this helicopter right now, because we are piloting it. Whether it goes up or down is to be determined. But if you're here, thanks for staying. Go watch Suicide Squad. Go read some reviews, what have you, and then come back here. If not, from here on out, we are talking spoilery stuff. We have all seen Suicide Squad, at least I'm assuming right now. So going along with our Batman versus Superman talk, I'm going to start things off with a little bit of a qualifying question, just sort of get us going a little bit on our jog here through this movie. Kevin, Suicide Squad, in your opinion, better or worse than Batman versus Superman?
Better, which is brutal to say, but I think it was better because it didn't have to deliver as much. You know what I mean? Like, there was a lot of pressure for Batman versus Superman, what it had to deliver. So, you know, we talked about the first time Harley Quinn was seen in a movie. This was the first Wonder Woman in a movie for BVS. And that said, she was the best part of that film. But I feel like because this movie wasn't delivering as much as the big three, it was able to succeed in a little more and not be as devastating, I think.
Alex, what about you?
Yeah, damning with faint praise. there are elements that I think they got right here. And I want to start by saying that because I think, like I said, I think Viola Davis as Amanda Waller was fantastic for the most part. And I think Will Smith really nails Deadshot. And, you know, I think it's kind of typical of Will Smith that he often finds himself having to carry more than he should in a lot of movies. And I think this ends up being one of those where I think it really suffers from a lack of creative direction. I think there's certain members of the team, and we can get into it deeper, that, you know, once you include them, it really forces the story to go in a direction that doesn't necessarily play, I think, to making this what it is in its best form. And I think there's a lot here that's just kind of frustrating when you know what this can be, because ultimately, to me, this just ends up being, you know, the first third is kind of light, almost over the top light, and then the last two thirds get really kind of dark and very quickly, and there's a lot of muddiness there too.
Yeah, both I'll just say both in the film and both in Enchantress, how she looks, just covered in mud.
Yes, exactly. You go with the darkest hue of character to represent your big bad. I think it's very representative of the movie. I'd agree. I think one of the reasons why I like Suicide Squad better than Batman versus Superman is because I would just say, as a general blanket statement about my taste in films, I would rather watch a film that's a bad comedy rather than a bad drama film that is really trying to just shoot for the stars and is barely getting off of that launching pad. I feel like Batman versus Superman really tried to feel important. It said, like, we want to say things about superheroes and about the world. And as a result, it kind of failed almost spectacularly on those levels because they were really trying to make themselves feel like they were going to have a million think pieces written about them. It turns out they had a million think pieces written about them for all the wrong reasons. Whereas Suicide Squad, you could tell they were sort of like, hey, we're just going to have fun doing this. No real, you don't really need to think about it too much. Just enjoy the action that's about to happen. And I do feel like there was a little bit of unfortunate chronology going on here in that, and I'm going to make a lot of Marvel movie comparisons here, and I do apologize for everyone who, you know, does not like the Marvel versus DC comparisons, because I can understand they probably not might not be apt all the time. But I would almost assume that WB thought Batman versus Superman is to Age of Ultron as Suicide Squad is to Ant-Man. Of like, this isn't going to be our biggest movie of the year, so let's just have like a small, fun, good time and think nothing of it. But because Batman versus Superman drew such contention, all eyes really turned, I would say almost unfairly, to this film. And as a result, people were really looking at it under a big magnifying glass, which might lead to my next question here. I don't know if you guys have read the reviews of Suicide Squad. It seems like we've all enjoyed the movie more than Batman versus Superman. But from what the reviews that I read, there are a lot of critics who not only didn't like Suicide Squad, not only didn't think it was a worse movie than Batman versus Superman. I even read one where somebody said it was the worst experience they ever had in a movie theater. Kevin, do you see any sort of validity to those statements? Why exactly do you think, and we got this question from Ryan Anthony, why do you think Suicide Squad was given such bad reviews?
I would say first, the person who had that worst movie experience, go back now. You have to go back in time. Watch Dark Harvest, a Scarecrow horror movie, and then come back to me, because I've seen far worse, like, especially horror movies, and experience in movies than this one, I have
what
to
about,
say.
What about Ballistic X versus Severed?
Oh,
that was
X
my
versus
worst
Severed?
Theater
so
experience.
So bad. So bad.
There's a montage of their feet as they run for like 30 seconds in that movie.
It's crazy, and that's I think that is hyperbolic in a statement of this being the worst movie going experience. Like, I understand, I think where it's coming from is essentially I looked this up earlier because my girlfriend and I were talking about this. Right now on Rotten Tomatoes, Suicide Squad stands at 26% and BVS stands at 27%. So not that big of a difference here.
Yeah, it's a game of inches in a really crappy game of football, yeah, to be honest.
And I think what it is at this point, I feel people were having like the rage to Suicide Squad is because it's like, how have you guys not gotten it? Like, Marvel has been doing it, and I know some people are like, you shouldn't compare it, but you should, because it's like, there's one group that's doing all their movies right for 15 years, and DC has not done it. I mean, and so with that point, with Man of Steel, with BVS, and now hitting here, it's like, how have you not gotten it? So I feel like people are getting really upset about this one because it's been just a slew of bad. And it's just like, they're mind boggled, in my opinion. I think that reflects to the harsher reviews at PBS.
Yeah, I feel like there's a lot of places you can poke holes. And obviously, you know, people are doing it. You can find reviews, and there's a lot of people saying a lot of things about why they're having issues with this movie and kind of the DCEU in general. But I think one thing that really stands out to me is that Marvel started their universe from page one of a book, page one, chapter one. You got origin stories of everyone. Then they came together. It all just followed logically. For some reason, they decided to start everything at a point where Batman's older and he's already like lost Robin, the second Robin. And there's like all this, you know, kind of backstory that either they're never going to explain, and so it's kind of, you know, either understood by some fans or will not be understood by others. Or in other cases, like in this movie, they explain the same thing like three different times. I think one thing Marvel's done a really good job of in building their universe is they give you just enough, and then they assume that if you really want to know the finer points beyond that, that you're going to go kind of research, like, okay, what are these Infinity Stones? What's the deal behind these? How will they play into the greater picture at large? I think there's really chapters in a book there that's being told of a greater story in a way that DC is just kind of like picking up from a place that's understood by a percentage of the audience, which is strange to me.
Yeah, it does seem that DC, and I even got this a little bit in BVS as well. It does seem like they're almost, I don't know, I feel like back in the 90s when people were making movies purely to sell toys, it seems like DC is sometimes making its movies only to kind of build up future releases. And I know Marvel does that too. You know, they'll have little post-credits teasers, but I mean, I'm thinking about like Batman versus Superman when they introduce the Flash and they introduce Aquaman on the computer. And it seems like they're really trying to say like, hey, just wait for the sequel when really you should focus on the one product here. What I will say about Suicide Squad over Batman versus Superman is yes, it's a better film, but that being said, guys, this is not a well-made film at all.
No.
I think if you boil it down to even like the small tenets of filmmaking, your basic math when you go to film school, like continuity, grammar in your freaking subtitles, I don't know, plotting, it just feels like this movie, while I definitely enjoyed myself at it more than Batman versus Superman, it still feels like they were failing at those core concepts.
Yeah, I feel like the other thing, too, is that the core concept is, I think, a very solid point, because it did not only as far as like movie making goes, because the plot itself makes no sense, but the actual concept of the squad, it's like they got the idea where it's just like, OK, it's a bunch of villains and you put them together and they go on missions. And it's like someone made that pitch and they go, cool, got it, and did not think or care to learn more about like what the Suicide Squad does, because to me the entire parameter of what was happening, it's an end of the world scenario. Like, why is the Suicide Squad addressing the end of the world? That is not what they do. And it started off really weird, because like, even if you break it down, it's like, okay, so this thing happened where Enchantress turned evil, which who would have seen that coming? When you have a 6,000-year-old god that you're holding prisoner. Anyway, so you have Enchantress who's trying to destroy the world, and then the Suicide Squad's like, all right, well, you're going in and you have to extract this person. I don't know why they didn't tell them. This is just bad writing, where it's just like they didn't tell the squad that they're going to rescue Amanda Waller because they wanted it to be a twist for the audience. Because even if the squad knew, they still had to do it because their heads would have exploded. So it was only for the benefit of the audience that it never said it was Amanda Waller. So they get Amanda Waller, she crashes, and she gets captured. And then they're like, well, let's go save her and then save the world. What if she didn't crash? Were they just going to leave? Who's going to take care of Enchantress? Batman? Like, what was the contingency plan there? Like, it just made no sense as to what the structure of what they were even doing. Like, and that to me is very, very, very problematic, because again, it escapes what the Suicide Squad is and are supposed to do. And that, yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot I think you can question. I mean, just in many different points of the movie. Another thing that really stuck out to me when they get to Amanda Waller's, when she just blatantly executes all these FBI agents exposed to something beyond their clearance level.
Oh my gosh.
Like, the whole world is exposed to something beyond their clearance level. Look outside your window, ma'am.
Exactly. I'm sure her plan was just to exterminate the entire city after they got Enchantress back and Incubus back in their respective bottles.
They would just tell everyone it's Gozer. It's fine.
But that's also like a fundamental issue I have with kind of the idea. I feel like a failure of this movie is a failure to understand some of these core characters. And I think one thing that's great about the character of Amanda Waller is that she doesn't pull the trigger herself. She has... she has microphones in the ear of every member of the team, and she can talk to the entire team, or she can talk to one member of the team, and she can micromanage, and she can say, you kill him. All right, now you kill him. Like, she never actually pulls the trigger. She just gives the order. And I think that makes her more powerful. I just don't understand that. Why did we go that way?
She would have done what the Joker did at the beginning of Dark Knight. She would have structured it that they all would have eliminated each other. Essentially, like, yes. That is how she acts. Like, you are 100% right. And to have her do that was like, here's the weird thing. And I feel like this is a broader point for why I have so many like boggly things about the DC Cinematic Universe. According to what we've seen in Man of Steel, BVS, and now Suicide Squad, Batman has killed more people than the villains of this movie combined, because they didn't kill people in this movie. They killed monsters. Amanda Waller killed more people than the villains did. And when you have a world where the on-screen Batman has murdered more people than all the villains in a villain movie combined, something's wrong. Something's very wrong.
Yeah, like the idea of Suicide Squad is to take villains and turn them into anti-heroes. But I mean, Will Smith in this movie is a straight up protagonist. Like, he's not an anti-hero in any sense.
Yeah, and I do want to talk about, I wouldn't say each of the members of the squad, because I would say one of the weirder things about this film is that I think it was billed as an ensemble film when it really turned out to be the story of like three squad members and then a bunch of other people kind of filling out the background.
Yeah.
One of the big things that I do want to talk about right at the top of our discussion here is the editing, which I think is the main facet of this movie that really came under fire. As we mentioned before, this movie decided to go back after the reception of Batman vs. Superman and the, I would say, nearly universal acclaim of Captain America Civil War to really go back and retool it and make sure it's brighter and funnier and it's more lighthearted. But this movie is just all over the place in its editing. As one key example, right at the beginning of the movie, you have two pre-credit scenes showcasing Deadshot and Harley Quinn in prison. And then we go to credits, and then we go to Amanda Waller, and she goes through the whole intro package. What was the purpose of showing those two people? They're going to be our main two squad members, but we're going to see them literally 5 seconds, 5 minutes after the fact. There was, in my opinion, no reason, unless you're a big Ike Barinholtz fan, to have these two scenes exist before the credits. And that's what my general feelings towards the editing in general, as sort of a microcosm of it, is that it just felt like the editors had no idea what they were doing in this film. It feels like there were scenes that were apparently cut that made, you know, that explained things a lot further or made things more extreme or more funny. And they decided to just kind of take these puzzle pieces and arrange this really sort of bastardized image that complicated the plot further, as Kevin just pointed out.
I gotta say, I can't remember the last time the music in a movie took me out of a movie more than in this movie. There was moments where it's just jumping from, and I feel like this was their attempt at Guardians of the Galaxy in many ways. Like, oh, that,
I completely agree.
And that soundtrack was such an that was a central theme of that movie. That soundtrack was like the tape that his mother gave. It's like is the last thing he has from Earth to hold on to. It's like his last piece of home. You didn't earn that in any respect to just like bounce from, you know, you don't own me to without me to, you know, it's just to Bohemian Rhapsody. It's just, it really felt like I was watching a sequence of trailers for a lot of the beginning of the movie.
Yeah, it's weird because I feel like this happens a lot with the DC stuff, is that it's surface readings of other things where, like, I think it's exactly what you said. They looked at the soundtrack of Guardians and were like, that's a really great soundtrack people love. And to them, it was like, oh, and it's full of pop songs, so we'll just play popular classic songs, right? And it's like, no, but you miss why those songs were used and how it was used. And so it's like they tried to mimic something else without really understanding why that worked in that other thing.
Benji Lewinsky asks, do you think that, like with Batman vs. Superman, there will be an ultimate cut released that far exceeds the theatrical cut? Kevin, what do you think the chances are that a few months from now, WB pulls a mea culpa and says, okay, we're going to release the movie the way David Ayer originally intended it on DVD, so now you'll be able to view it without complaining about the editing style?
I mean, I think they're going to have to, just to make finance back to a certain point. I think the movie had a big opener, but so did BVS, and it didn't have long legs, and I feel like it might suffer from that. But my main complaint is that they should, when you release a movie, that should be the movie. Like, the fact that they had to release this ultimate edition of BVS, and they have to release this other, you know, edition of Suicide Squad, if they do, is sort of like a faulty fallacy in that it's just, oh, well, this is the movie, it was supposed to be like this. And it's like, well, then why wasn't that the movie, you know? But I definitely think there will, because I have read that there are actually a lot more Joker scenes that were cut from this film.
Granted, I believe, isn't that from Jared Leto himself,
But there is, I actually saw screenshots and images and stuff. So like this stuff is out there that existed. And from there's a lot actually, people who went to the original test screenings, talked about scenes that were cut from the film featuring the Joker, including a fight scene with the squad. The Joker was supposed to fight the Suicide Squad and that got cut. So like there is evidence to exist that supports Jared Leto's apparent insanity that he's been going through in this film.
Yeah, I could definitely see that. And I mean, I even saw an article, I forget who the journalist was, but they sort of compared they sent a tweet after they saw the first cut of Suicide Squad and said, wow, can't wait for everyone to see Suicide Squad. That was a great movie. And then after the theatrical release, they said, what just happened? Like, they reordered all these scenes, they put in new scenes, now this is a much worse product. So hopefully they'll unearth that first cut to release. I don't want it to be a lost mythical product that now exists out there in the universe, which segues into our talk about the characters of the film. Now, I just mentioned this before, but Alex R. Philly asks, why make an ensemble film when the vast majority of the characters are going to be overlooked and underdeveloped? Now, I don't know if I want to be as hyperbolic as R. Philly just said, but I personally feel like this movie was really marketed as the Suicide Squad, whereas it seemed like the Suicide Squad in the film turned out to be a lot more stratified, in that we really, as I said before, got to know about three or four of them, and then there were some other colorful members kind of filling out the rest of the cast.
Yeah, it's frustrating. I mean, you could definitely do more. Like, for example, I think I didn't really understand, you know, like I still don't have any good memories of Captain Boomerang, and I was really excited to see him in the movie. I mean, there's really not much he was there for. Killer Croc, I mean, he doesn't really bring much to the table there. Enchantress, to me, just like, the element of magic doesn't need to be in the Suicide Squad, and if it does, that doesn't need to be how you introduce magic to the universe. Magic is already a tricky element to introduce to your universe, as shown by how Marvel has taken so long to bring Doctor Strange to the table, because that's such a weird place to go. They've really like set the table full before they've gotten there. And to me, yeah, like dropping Enchantress in this movie is just almost destined to take it in a direction that's counter to what you're trying to make this, apparently, which is, you know, a lighthearted kind of summer action blockbuster.
Kevin, as someone who knows the Suicide Squad from the comic books, were you excited by the iteration that we ultimately got and what we saw on the screen? Were there some members of the squad that you wish we had seen more of, like Alex Fields with Captain Boomerang?
It's so weird because I think, you know, before I continue to say, because there's just been so much negativity for me from this, I will say couple things that are, I think Will Smith was great because he's Will Smith. But like it is weird that he essentially just plays a good guy again, despite the fact that they tried to convince you by telling you over and over again that they're bad guys. He's clearly a protagonist. Harley Quinn, I have to say, was pretty good. I actually kind of like their Harley Quinn, and I have some complaints, but no major ones. I think she did a great job. And I also liked Captain Boomerang, except, like, you know, Alex said, I would have liked more of him because, like, he had moments. Like, he was kind of the comedy element that I wanted from this movie. He brought a lot of the humor that I hoped the movie was. Like, he had that weird, you know, the thing with the pink unicorn. He had that amazing scene where as soon as, you know, they told him you can leave, he just grabbed his beer and walked out. And I honestly wish we never saw him again. I wish that was his
exit.
I
completely agree.
It would have been such a great comedic moment. And it's weird to say, but I feel like part of the problem is that this movie should have been funny. It should have been fun. It was marketed now, because of the weird twisting, as a fun, funny movie. And we got kind of no humor. It's like DC still doesn't understand what humor is, almost, for certain things and how to do it. Like, it's really weird. But that all said, liked Deadshot. I liked Harley. I liked what we saw at Captain Boomerang. But you guys kind of nailed it in that the other characters are just there. Why was Katana there? What was she there for? You know, Killer Croc was the same way.
And I mean, could you elaborate, is Katana, as she is in the film, is she more so on the side of Rick Flag to begin with and the government, or is she also kind of on her own path and she gets brought into the Suicide Squad as a criminal as well?
Katana isn't a typical member of the Suicide Squad. Usually it's like a newer shift they've tried to do to bring to like make the character more prominent, which, hey, more power to that. But Katana is never really portrayed as like this like villain or, you know, like someone bad. She's definitely a good guy, quote unquote, in most of her interpretations. So in the sense of like she was brought in and is on Rick Flagg's side, that makes more sense because she is supposed to be a good guy. So I understood why that was angled that way. But like, again, like she had no presence in the movie besides like another character for what they had to make an ensemble, which is weird. And not to mention,
she like pops in halfway through. I'm sorry. She pops in halfway through and Rick Flagg's like, oh yeah, this is my friend and bodyguard. And then we see like a 30-second clip of her in Japan. I'm like, all right, well, that's what it is. Like,
yeah.
Yeah, I will say across the board, actually, I think the performances might have been my favorite part of the film. I feel like with a couple of exceptions, everyone was actually cast really well. I do agree about, you know, Will Smith as Deadshot is almost painted as, he's definitely painted as sympathetic and he's almost painted as a protagonist. But part of me kind of wonders if that's just because of Will Smith. I was really excited. One of the things I was really happy about going into this film was like, oh, great, we get to see Will Smith as a bad guy. But the guy is just so damn charming. I mean, I know you talk about how Captain Boomerang is kind of the comic relief, but Deadshot is like throwing a bunch of sly remarks at Rick Flagg's way as well. I guess we can talk a little bit about Deadshot while we're sort of on the subject. I mean, again, I love Will Smith. I feel like this is a great return to form after some not so great films in the past decade or so. Cough, cough, After Earth. But I thought he did the character justice. I thought it was great to make him sort of the main character. He had a lot of heart. I will say the whole daughter thing I wasn't entirely into, especially there are a few lines that I really picked out of this film that were groan worthy. And the one in the first flashback scene where he's like, oh, why don't you come live with me? And his daughter flat out says, mom said I can't live with you because you kill people. It's just like such a bad line that it almost took me out of the entire experience. But that being said, I thought Will Smith is just so great of an actor that he did a really, really great job with the role. We do have a question about Will Smith that I'd be intrigued to hear, especially from you, Kevin, as a big comic book guy. Do you wish DC would have cast Will Smith as a more prominent figure in their universe? Asked Carlos Vidal.
Yes. I love Will Smith. I genuinely love Will Smith. I mean, Fresh Prince was a big part of growing up, and especially being a minority, it dealt with a lot of issues that shows of that time did not deal with. So like, and he's a phenomenal actor. I mean, it showed back in Fresh Prince, it shows now. I really wish he could have been cast as like a bigger, more prominent hero. Because, and it's weird because he does a good job with Deadshot, but like, as we've stated, he plays a protagonist, he plays a hero. And it's Will Smith. I've heard this rumor a long time ago that Will Smith does not play bad guys. Like he, as an actor, has chosen not to play a villain ever. And so when he signed up for Deadshot, I kind of had a feeling that they were going to have to tweak the character to make him more heroic than he actually is in the comics. And we did see that in this movie. That all said, I loved his performance. I thought he was charming. He's one of my favorite parts of the film. But because of who he is, I wish he just straight up played a DC hero. And it would have been amazing to see him in a more prominent, like, actual movie. You know, like an actual focused movie just on him.
Mm-hmm. Alex, I mean, there's this whole concept with Deadshot of this is the guy who never misses, and I'm sure we'll talk about the Deadshot Harley relationship going in, but there's that one moment where Amanda Waller asks him to shoot her as she's escaping with the Joker, and he chooses not to. Did you feel weight in that scene? Do you feel like Deadshot was a good character in this film? And I don't mean good in terms of the moral spectrum. Do you think he was a well-written character, despite how much Will Smith worked in this performance?
I think Will Smith did everything he could with what he had. I think the acting was definitely far and away the best part of this movie. I think, you know, the rumor is that the script was put together in about 6 weeks, and I think it kind of shows in a lot of places where it just could have benefited from more time to kind of go over some of this stuff. I think, you know, the Batman Assault on Arkham, you know, animated movie that I referenced that I really enjoy, establishes, you know, a Deadshot and a Harley relationship. And I think it does it much more quickly, but also it earns it in a way that this really doesn't. And also, I think, you know, there are some things that it does that, you know, one thing this movie does is ignore some things, like I said, and then over-explain other things. And one thing that could have been done, I think, is just have Will Smith, like, looking at a picture of his daughter while he's in jail mm-hmm. over and over. Like, you don't need to keep cutting to these flashbacks. And that was another thing. A lot of flashbacks, a lot of, like, you know, you begin to wonder, like, all right, well, whose perspective is this? And is this, are we still in real time? And there was really not a lot of differentiation besides, like, a color wipe at times. So it was a little bit disorienting, I thought.
All right, let's talk about Harley Quinn. Yes. As Alex said, she's become a very popular person in the fandom. Margot Robbie, many other films, including Wolf of Wall Street, was signed on to play. Kevin, you thought, you said she was pretty good, verbatim. I really, really enjoyed her. I thought she really did a good job with it. Personally, I would say I want her crazier. I think Amanda Waller says at a point, maybe during her intro package, of, you know, she's like the Joker, but some say she's even crazier. And I really didn't see the manic side of her. I saw the very snide, sarcastic, lawful, chaotic side of her. But otherwise, she seemed pretty mellow for someone that, even though we'll talk about Jared Leto's Joker probably in a little bit, she doesn't seem as crazy and chaotic as the sidekick of the Joker would have me to believe. Kevin, do you agree? And what are your overall thoughts on the Harley Quinn performance?
Yeah, I kind of think you hit a very important point. And it is that when I said pretty good, it's because the crazy was lacking. And it's, you know, it's, again, this is a bigger thing of the movie of, like, you want these villains. The whole thing with these villains is that you want it to be fun. You want to have them have fun while taking out these monsters. They didn't seem like they enjoyed themselves at all. And even Harley, who should have been so much more smiley, happy, crazy while fighting, it all was just kind of like your typical fight scenes. And that's what she was missing, that crazier element. That said, that scene with Deadshot where she tries to shoot her, is actually, I think, the most Harley moment, where she plays mm-hmm. dead for a second and then pops up with that smile. In that moment, I was like, that's Harley. Like, it was the most Harley Quinn moment in the entire movie. Just that hanging there and then that pop-up with that smile, it was like Harley Quinn just came to life to me. And it was that moment, in my opinion.
I would say I was very surprised, considering the previous sound editing of this film, that they didn't play Pat Benatar's Hit Me With Your Best Shot while he was lining that up. Right on the nose with those music choices.
If they had done that, I think I would have broken and been like, all right, brain's off forever now. I'll just enjoy this for what it is.
Alex, we have a question from Jake M. Larson. Do you think Harley Quinn has enough to get a standalone movie? Now, considering Margot Robbie's performance and DC's and the general comic book universe's love for producing sequels, what do you think the chances are of a Harley Quinn film? Or do you think Harley Quinn might appear in this Batman prequel that's going to be coming out in the next years?
Yeah, I could see them going either way. I could definitely see the possibility of, yeah, I don't know if it would be like a Harley Quinn origin movie, but I could definitely see her in some kind of Batman, you know, earlier Batman story, because I think she's definitely someone that you want as a more prominent character in whatever you're doing. Like, certainly if a Joker's a main antagonist, then you want her involved. I think one thing that makes it a little hard to do a full Harley Quinn origin movie is the fact that we spent a decent amount of time doing that in this movie, I think. You know, there was a lot of, you know, they kind of yada yada through some of it, but there was definitely some elements of, you know, Harley was the psychiatrist at Arkham, and she was, you know, tasked to analyze the Joker and instead fell in love with him and that kind of stuff. And, you know, I would like to see more of that, but I don't know that given what they gave us that they plan on touching on that beyond what they did.
Kevin, Harley's flashback actually brings up a good point. We see Batman appear twice in this film, and they're both during the Deadshot and Harley Quinn, I'll call them apprehending sequences, where it turns out Batman is the one to bring them in. First off, as someone who was very vocal about their opinions on BVS, even though I believe you were very, you praised Ben Affleck's performance, were you happy to see him here? Was it too little Batman? Were you not happy that he didn't show up in any other parts of the movie, especially apprehending the Suicide Squad? Give me your thoughts about Batman's cameo in Suicide Squad.
I actually, I liked his cameos. I preferred that they were as limited as they were. There's a great graphic novel by Brian Azzarello and Libra Mayhill called Joker. That is basically an entire story from the Joker's perspective and all the bat villains, and Batman barely appears in it. And to me that makes sense because if you're these villains, Batman's not there all the time. Like he just shows up every now and then and beats you up and then arrests you. And so I like this idea of he's not super prevalent in the film. You only see these glimpses of him through the eyes of what the villains would have experienced. And I kind of really like that. I liked him more in the Harley Joker. Like I think he felt more like belonging there. His stuff with Deadshot was clearly just a weird thing of trying to establish Deadshot's motivations. Like, it was clearly just he was a plot device in that moment, whereas with the Joker-Harley scene, I felt like he made sense for that moment, which is weird because it's just like he only had two scenes, and I said I like the amount, but I wish that one of them was less and one of them was more. I don't know.
I will say about those introductory scenes as well, they might have been one of my favorite parts of the film. I don't know if you feel the same way, but the scenes reminded me a lot cinematography-wise of something out of like Scott Pilgrim versus the World with, you know, the lettering that shows up next to them and how dynamic it is and how stylized those flashback scenes were. And Alex, I know these people, you know, they compare it to like the first like third of the film because it does take a little while to get everyone kind of caught up on, as you said before, really pulling the expository rope here on who those people were. Did you enjoy the flashback / introductory sequences as a whole? Did you think they went on for too long? Did you like the stylization of them? Give me your thoughts.
Mixed bag, I guess. I thought, you know, some of it was really good. I think you kind of have to do it that way. A little confusing sometimes, and I thought we spent too much time on some people. And then, you know, when we don't do anything on Slipknot and then he shows up, it's like, well, this is obviously the guy that's going to die first. And sure enough, yep, he's the one we make an example of by showing you how Amanda Waller's app on her phone works. But, you know, side note, I do think that, you know, my favorite moment of Margot Robbie in this movie, and I thought, like, you know, arguably the most Harley Quinn moment is in the flashback where Batman goes to save her from drowning and she just starts laughing in his face and attacking him. Like, that's totally Harley Quinn. Like, even in the face of death, she, like, that's when she's having her most fun. So I enjoyed that a lot. Yeah, I think it was definitely a mixed bag. There were certain elements, like when you get the flashback at the beginning and there's all these words flashing through the screen. And I think one was like that Harley Quinn accomplice in Robin's murder. And I'm like, whoa, what? Like, there's just a lot. It was kind of busy at times, I think.
Yeah, they were definitely trying to pack a lot in those moments too. And like, it's that Easter eggy moment to be like, oh, right, the Joker killed Robin in this world. We got to make sure to reference that here. So tick that box off, you know, have these flashbacks in this Joker Harley thing to prepare for the next Batman movie. Tick that box off. Overall, again, I thought Margot Robbie was so good though. She's such a great actress. Mm-hmm. And like that bar scene, arguably my favorite scene in the movie, actually, as a whole. She was phenomenal in.
I would argue that bar scene is, I think, what people wanted Suicide Squad to be.
Yeah.
As a film was like, let's just have, it's almost like, again, I don't want to keep making Marvel comparisons, but like in Avengers Age of Ultron in the very beginning when they finish that party and it's them just sort of having that contest to see who can pick up Mjolnir. It's a very comparable type of scene of, let's just put these characters together without any sort of purpose, without any sort of goal to work towards, and just see how they interact with each other. And in my opinion, that was one of the better scenes of the film. We've talked about him, and we've talked about him, guys. Let's reference the clown in the room, Jared Leto as the Joker. Kevin, I'm going to go back to what we had, a question I kind of posed a little while ago. When you first heard that Jared Leto was cast as the Joker, a really iconic film role, arguably more iconic than Batman, considering that we have someone as the Joker win an Oscar in their lifetime, were you happy with this choice, and how did your thoughts reflect on Jared Leto's performance overall?
It's crazy. I could write a thesis about the Joker in this movie. So I have lots of feelings about this stuff. When they announced Jared Leto, I was so on board. Like, I think that Jared Leto's a great actor. I think that his look is the most Joker physically, because the Joker in the comics can be so thin and gangly and just creepy looking. You know, like, he just has a build that no other actor has reflected yet. And Jared Leto has that build, that kind of creepy, almost too thin look. And I feel like he could have pulled it off. Then that first image came out and it just made me like, ah, it's a typical, like, swing and a miss. You almost had it. You almost hit a home run, but you swung and you missed it. Because that look, that hand on his head, the posture, how he looks with the shirt off physically, everything physically about his face and how he looks is spot on Joker in that image. But then they added, like, okay, he looks great. Let's make this busier. Let's add some tattoos. Let's add some bling. We'll give him, you know, messed up teeth. We'll do this. And it's just like, oh, man, you had it. All I needed was that image not with nothing on him. And he looks creepy. He looked so creepy. But then they made it a joke, ha, by putting all that stuff on him. And you see him and you're just like, oh my God, what is that? You know, and that was so, like, that's already going in. I already had, like, oh gosh, they had it and then they missed it. And then they just, then they kept making it worse because it was the most, like, the marketing in this movie is bananas because they kept doing these things where it's like, Jared Leto did this crazy thing to the cast. Look how crazy and method he is, right, guys? Look, he's method and crazy. Aren't you impressed? Aren't we cool? And it's just like, oh my God, you're making it worse. Just stop talking.
Like, yeah, the shot in Freud and me kind of loved following that saga because as someone who was previously a performer in their lifetime, I am personally not into the whole idea of method acting, especially when it causes you to cause harm onto your other cast members. Like, there are stories of what? Jared Leto sending his cast members used condoms and, like, desiccated pigs. It just, that went a step too far. And you have, like, Will Smith and Viola Davis speaking out being like, yeah, that was pretty effed up.
Yeah, I would not be surprised, personally, if that wasn't Jared Leto's fault. Like, if Warner Brothers told him, you have to do these things. Because they wanted it, they wanted the public to have this perception of, like, how into the Joker he is. It's like, it was so try hard. Like, I can't imagine him actually doing that on his own. I feel like it was a mandate to be like, look, you got to be a weirdo. We're sorry. But if you want this role and you signed this contract, this is what you have to do. You have to be psychotic. And so he was forced to do this and he can't say anything because it's a break of contract. But, like, that's my take on it. And I know it's conspiracy theory level, but that's 100% what I think actually happened.
Alex, did we get too little Joker in this film? I feel like aside from the editing complaints, one of the big sticking points that a lot of people had in this film was that Jared Leto, as the wackadoo marketing that Kevin alluded to occurred over the past few months, is that Jared Leto was built up as this big part of the film. It turns out he's in maybe, what, like 15 combined minutes of the entire 2+ hour film. Did that detract from the character for you at all?
Yeah, well, it made me hard to really judge Jared Leto as the Joker. Like, I feel like from what I got, at least his acting pretty good. Like, I don't really have any complaints about it, but there's just not a lot to go off of. And then, yeah, like Kevin said, I feel like a lot of the creatives, again, a lot of my problems aren't with the actors. I feel like, you know, they, for the most part, are doing the best with what they're given across the board. But Jared Leto is, yeah, they dress him up too much. And again, this movie, like, it just seems so obvious to me that if you remove the Enchantress element and magic completely from this context and this story, remove Katana because she's bringing some magical element and that doesn't need to be there at all. And then just make, like, the Joker the main villain. Like, the Joker's got a dirty bomb and he's going to blow up the city. And or like, so, you know what I mean? Like, that's really a much more constructive and a much more constructive direction to go. And it's also something that the Suicide Squad seems tailored to do. Like, that's why you would need Harley Quinn, because why else would you bring a girl with a baseball bat unless she has some kind of knowledge of the Joker or of where you're going or something like that? So it's a lot of just conceptual decisions, I think, that this film suffers from more than anything else.
Go ahead, Kevin.
I was going to say, Alex, is it weird to come up with a better plot for the movie in 5 seconds than they did in the 6 weeks?
Yeah, you know, I mean, but again, 6 weeks. It's like, man, take 6 months, please. Take eight. Like,
yeah, it is weird, again, that they felt like, oh, we got to, like, keep fresh on the heels of our big success, Batman versus Superman, or we got to, you know, purge the mind of our audiences and make sure they know we can do rainbow happy fun time. The Joker, oddly enough, didn't leave that big of an impression on me. Maybe it's because of the lack of screen time, or Jared Leto, to me, almost played the Joker as Jim Carrey kind of played the Riddler, but on Ritalin, in that he was very expressive and a little wacky at times. And I'll admit I wasn't a big fan of how they were kind of portraying him as a gangster. I realize that's probably more akin to Jack Nicholson as the Joker in Batman 89 versus Heath Ledger as the Joker, this self-admitted agent of chaos from The Dark Knight. But that being said, whenever he popped up on the film, I was intrigued to see what would happen next, but he really didn't do that much crazy stuff. I mean, he had his henchmen burst in and wearing masks, and nonsensically one of them wearing like a bear suit, a full bear suit, which was really confusing to me. But overall, I would say the Joker didn't really pop for me, and I don't want to necessarily fault Jared Leto. I would be interested to see these other scenes and see him possibly be a little more psycho that all of the crazy method stunts, whether marketed prompting or not, might have brought about. But here it just seemed like he was just a character. I wouldn't even call the Joker stuff a B-plot as much as I would call it just sort of like a remora that's kind of clinging to the giant shark underbelly that is Suicide Squad.
I will say, I think what you said about the gangster thing, I think that was my personal biggest complaint about the Joker, even more than honestly how he looked, it was, which I guess is actually tied in, because it's like Jack, you mentioned Jack Nicholson had this gangster aspect of the Joker, but it was like his more gangster nature was pre, or like as mob nature was, you know, pre, him transforming. Like after he transformed, he became unhinged and weird and crazy. Whereas this Joker was like Joker by way of Tony Montoya. He's in the club. He's like, he's literally dressed like Tony at one point, and he's wearing this suit, the shirt open, and he has a cane and all the jewelry, and he's like looking around, and I'm like, that's what? Like, so like that was my biggest thing. If I closed my eyes throughout a lot of his scenes, like the when he first appeared, he's in complete darkness. Loved the voice. I loved his mannerisms, and I loved the things he said. But like every time I looked, it was just like, oh my God, you're right there. But the one thing I think they actually did really well on was Joker and Harley's relationship. I actually really liked how they handled that.
Yeah, and it's interesting. I believe from what I read, there is some discrepancy in previous editions of the comic book of how Harley gets transformed. I know that I think in previous iterations, the Joker throws her in because he's kind of like caught her in his web, whereas here, he almost convinces her to do it. And I'd agree, you know, even though the flashbacks were not evenly balanced, if they did, they focused a lot on the Harley and Joker relationship, which again probably informed this B plot, if you call it more than anything. Because part of, you know, if you didn't know Joker and Harley Quinn going into the movie, you'd be like, okay, why is this guy chasing after her? But having this relationship really be fleshed out, and I'm assuming more fleshed out as we got to see them, hopefully in this Batman prequel, I feel like they took a step in the right direction there. Alex, you had mentioned before that the Joker would have probably worked better as a general antagonist. I do want to take this opportunity to talk about our antagonist, which is Enchantress, and I guess you can call you can call her brother an antagonist as well, though he's sort of like is her loyal sidekick. As we said, she's kind of introduced as a prospective member of the squad, and then she kind of turns evil and becomes the big bad for the majority of the film. Did you like that turn? Were you happy with how they used Enchantress here?
Not especially. You know, one thing I thought was really cool is when you see June Moon's hand grabbed by the black hand of the Enchantress and she flips over.
That was a great transformation.
That was a great, like, that's very Enchantress. That was very cool. I think it was just all kind of messy. I think the fact that you had to say the brother of the Enchantress and you didn't know it was Incubus speaks volumes. You know what I mean? Like, why do we not all obviously know the name of one of the main antagonistic creations of this movie? They didn't really – I don't even know if the word Incubus was said throughout the course of the film.
Yeah, they really – I was going to say the Incubus thing, it's weird because it's like I feel like they kept – They had like, oh, this is Enchantress and she's gonna be part of the team as part of the like not seeing that she's the villain thing coming. I mean, they honestly should have just made it Blaze and Satanas, and I feel like that would have made a lot more sense because I felt like the characters fit Blaze and Satanas more than they did Enchantress at all. But that would have given away that they were the villains, I guess. It was a weird choice as well, I agree.
Yeah, and I think I think usually in Suicide Squad, like when you see Enchantress in there, and it's sporadic, Enchantress isn't as common in iterations of Suicide Squad as, say, like Deadshot or Captain Boomerang even. But when you see Enchantress, it's almost like she is kind of this Jekyll and Hyde Hulk element where like, oh, we don't want – like June Moon is afraid to do it and we don't want her to do it because – like
you don't
want to
wake up the dark girl.
Right. You only do it in like the most dire of circumstances. Like you're only going to allow this to happen in the situation where there's literally – you're exhausted all options and there's nothing else left to try. And the fact that she was just out there like with very little supervision and that June was so willing, and they didn't really explain why June was just cool with saying it and giving over her entire life. Like that was, I think, a bit of an issue. I think just, you know, Enchantress is it works in the Suicide Squad when you have the right combination. But the cocktail, I think, was just a little off here.
It was interesting to me at the big climax of the film when they do finally encounter Enchantress and Incubus, because I definitely thought there's going to be a moment when like Rick Flag goes up to Enchantress and said like, June, I know you're in there somewhere. Fight her, June, fight her. Because one of the things that really drew me into the idea of Enchantress in this film is, Alex, what you just brought up, this whole two dueling personalities, the Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde of June Moon and Enchantress. And it was weird that Enchantress was so powerful, she just sort of took over June and we didn't see her for a good portion of time. And speaking of a good portion of time, I feel like both of these villains disappeared for what, like the middle 45 minutes of the film. Like they got introduced, they ended up, you know, betraying Amanda Waller, they got her heart back, and they sort of created their big obelisk catastrophe. And then we just stick with the Suicide Squad for a long, long time, and we only really see them at the end, and we only really see them in that middle portion through their putty-like army that they send out to fight these guys. I don't know if you feel the same way, Kevin. I was a little confused by many plotting elements of this film, but one of them being that the whole middle portion of this film, the big villains were not present whatsoever.
Yeah, no, for sure. And it's weird because, like, I read an article recently about villains as a whole, recent, like, in cinema, and how villains aren't as memorable anymore. And that definitely is going to suffer from this, because people are going to, I think, even forget that she was the villain of this movie, which is, a weird choice because, like, again, them going in to, like, accomplish a mission amongst craziness works for the Suicide Squad. Them saving the world is not very Suicide Squad-y. So it's so weird to see these two elements having to be forced together, especially when, like you said, for 45 minutes, the villains aren't even around. I do have a question, though, and it's a weird question, but any of you other two notice, like, I don't know if it was Cara Delevingne, I think I pronounced her name right, choice or director. Like, every time the Enchantress was on screen, especially at the end, she was gyrating in the weirdest arm flaily hip movement way, and it detracted every time, because I was always like, what is happening? Like, what is she doing right now?
It was a different time back then, Kevin, from when Enchantress was from. They were communicating in very different ways with their body language.
Yeah, apparently.
Did you guys hear that the directing team had her walk naked in the woods to get comfortable with the idea of being, like, feral and naturalistic?
For real?
Is that, like, did Jared Leto take over as director for, like, 3 days and nobody noticed?
What is that? Like, that's a type – I wish I never knew that. Go walk naked in the woods, Kara.
Yeah,
right. I wish I did not know that. I am not comfortable with that. It's the same thing, like, you know, this is a whole other level of discussion, but, like, this movie, every time the focus was on the crew, it's always front shots. But whenever Harley was on screen, they always swung the camera behind her. And it was so gratuitous, and I felt so, like, why? Especially in a movie full of dudes. Like, how is there not a lot of male eye candy? Like, Will Smith, why are you, like, how are you not, like, shirtless for more of this movie? Like, it was... mind-boggling to a certain extent that this happens still.
I could feel there's a little bit of pandering considering that Harley spends the majority of the film outside of prison in, like, short shorts and, like, a crop top. And I think there's even an AV Club article that I can link in the show notes, which says, like, is enough with sexualizing Margot Robbie? Because they even have her, spoiler alert for The Big Short, she's part of, like, a hilarious tangent, but still sort of a sexualized tangent at that, where it's like, here's Margot Robbie in a bathtub talking to you about bank loans. And it feels like this is like a step beyond, I feel like, what they do with Black Widow in the Avengers, where they're just like, nah, we don't really need to do anything with her. Let's just slap her, slap some hot clothes on her and have her front and center and have the camera swing around to show her butt.
Yeah, it's just very upsetting, especially since, and this is a recent comic thing, there's an over-sexualization of Harley Quinn where it's much more recent in the comics that they do this. Like, back in her animated series stuff, she wasn't so, I guess, over, like, sexualized. It's weird because what I specifically mean is, like, that scene at the beginning where she licks the bar, like, that isn't a Harley thing to do. It's a more recent because they've started to be like, let's make her into the sex bot, which I just, it's just so weird because it's like, I don't know. I don't like that take on the character to a certain extent. And it's not because I'm uncomfortable with, you know, women doing that. I don't know. It's weird to explain that, but like just that interpretation of just having to be, you know, that's how we have to make her. And of course this movie like fails the Bechdel test terribly. I think the only thing that worked was when she Harley introduced herself to Katana. I think that's it, and that is a hello. So it's not really a conversation. But yeah, it's so weird and like, yeah.
I was wondering which one of us was going to mention the Bechdel test first, because it really, really comes into play here, I think, in a lot of ways. And
oh man,
yeah, you know, there's. I especially thought when I saw the cast list, I'm like, okay, Enchantress and Katana, they're there specifically because they want to have some strong female characters that are lacking from some iterations of the Suicide Squad. And that's not what they are at all. Katana's such an afterthought. Enchantress is Enchantress in this movie. And yeah, I think, you know, and then there's certain elements of the Harley Quinn story that, like, here's one thing that bothered me. Like, I agree with Kevin that the Harley and Joker relationship I thought was really good. But that first initial scene where she helps him break out of Arkham, and then his first act is to, like, just mess with her head. Like, well, she was already seduced into finding him a machine gun and helping him break out of Arkham. Like, I didn't understand why that was then the moment where, like, I'm going to hurt you really badly. Like, that didn't really make sense to me, and I know these characters, so like, I think there was a few scenes like that where it's just like, why is this, you know, why is this person getting beaten? Like, why? Yeah. There's a few moments of just male on female violence that I was just like,
I was going to say, that scene, we can actually talk more. It's going to sound crazy, but like, I actually liked that moment where he was torturing her in a way, because it was like, he tricked her into falling in love with him, and then he was being the sadistic person because he didn't, quote unquote, have feelings for her at the time. Like, when she jumps into the acid, that bath, he was going to leave her, and it wasn't until he stopped and he realized, like, almost in a way, like, oh my God, I actually think I love this chick. And he jumps in after her. Like, I kind of like that it was the Joker being crazy, but then realizing he actually loves someone. And that entire relationship from that point on, too, was two people very much in love with each other. And I kind of really liked that it wasn't like he wasn't treating her terribly when they were in a relationship. You know, it was like before, because he was a lunatic, which, again, not to support this type of behavior from a normal, healthy relationship. But for right. two psychotic killers, this is a lovely relationship they're in. You know, right.
That's something that needs to be established. This has never been a healthy relationship and never will be in any iteration of anything. And yeah. No, I think you explained it really well, and in many ways better than I think the movie did. And that was really my problem with it, I guess, is that it all happened so fast that it didn't really seem like an arc that was earned. And then we got to the kind of the point that you're talking about where, okay, they're psychotic Romeo and Juliet. But yeah, you're right. That arc happened. It just happened so fast that I guess I kind of missed it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Speaking of unearned romantic arcs, or romantic Arkhams, if you will, we just spoke about Enchantress. Let's speak about June Moon's romantic partner and the de facto lead of the Suicide Squad, Rick Flagg, portrayed by Joel Kinnaman. Kevin, tell me, Rick Flagg in the comics, so he's not a metahuman, correct? He's just a soldier that's kind of being brought in, so he kind of brings that more civilian perspective rather than the villain perspective to the squad?
Correct. In the comics, he's very much, he's not a villain, he's a military man, and he leads the very, very, very first Suicide Squad iteration way back in the day, which was kind of like hero analogs, not villains. So he's whatever he leads them, he is very much like the civilian, I guess, chaperone of these villains.
he's like Amanda Waller's TA.
Yeah, essentially, yeah. Like, he's not the man in charge. It's like that Smith, the Will Smith scene where, you know, he says, I'm not talking to you, I'm talking to the person in charge, and it's Amanda Waller, and he's kind of like, you know, the lackey here at this point, but he is there to make sure they stay in line.
Yeah, and it, among all these crazy characters, he in any iteration, he's always going to be your straight man if he's there.
Yeah.
Just by default.
Well, that being said, Alex, do you think Joel Kinnaman popped as the proverbial straight man? Because I'll admit, I knew nothing about Rick Flagg going in, and he was kind of akin to the drywall on those buildings that were getting blown up in the movie, in my opinion. I know he had the connection with June, but outside of that, I couldn't really find many discerning qualities of him besides, like, he's from the military and he's by the books.
Yeah. So this is, I think, you know, Kevin just touched on it. Rick Flagg is from the original Suicide Squad before there was ever this whole rebranding of they're going to be a team of villains. And, you know, he has been featured in the, you know, Suicide Squad series since then. But really, his initial role was in a very different kind of a team, like a team to send when the Avengers aren't around, or sorry, when the Justice League isn't around. And so that's not what Suicide Squad became, ultimately. So I think, honestly, you can do without him in this movie entirely. I think Amanda Waller's presence in people's brains with a bomb and in people's ears is enough that, you know, that's why you're sending in the Suicide Squad. You're using them instead of trained operatives, so you don't have to waste guys like Rick Flagg. So I think in some ways this is something that could be done without him. I think that allows Will Smith as Deadshot to be the straight man that really he's kind of set up to be. And I think that's part of the problem is that there's two quasi-straight men in a team that, you know, lacks definition to begin with a bit.
Mm-hmm. Kevin, I know there's a little bit of a deviation where I don't believe Rick Flagg is in a relationship with June Moon in some iteration of Suicide Squad in the comic books. Do you like the choice of making Rick and June in a relationship? Do you think it gave him some much needed character weight as to why he decides to go fight Enchantress ultimately?
Yeah, as much as that can be given for this situation, I'm kind of with you that he was just kind of there as like you said, the dry beige wall. And I did like that he was upset that he was he was being used to keep Enchantress in line. Like, this was obviously a plot by Amanda Waller to have them fall in love to begin with. But yeah, it's also, it's just weird because it's like one of those things where it's just like, Enchantress will have her be in a relationship. That'll keep her hesitant from transforming and keep her grounded, as opposed to just being a strong, independent woman as June Moon who chooses what she wants to do and not have to have a guy basically control her to do that. But, you know, that's a level of dissection that I feel like is intense for me. But, I would have preferred if it was not that. Like, this movie really, like you said, did not need him there, and there's nothing about him that, like, seriously stuck out even.
Yeah, and I'm glad you brought it up, actually, because just, you know, off the top of my head, it is a situation where this relationship is just not – yeah, I mean okay, I forgot where I was going with this thought. Go ahead.
No problem. Let's touch upon a few other members of the squad that were not – has fleshed out or brought to the spotlight as Deadshot or Rick Flagg or Harley Quinn. I want to talk about El Diablo. Alex, can you tell me a little bit about your thoughts about Jay Hernandez? You probably had the biggest quote unquote sob story of all the Suicide Squad.
Yeah. El Diablo, is not always a prominent member of the squad. You know, he's sometimes involved. I think in this movie, it was kind of weird. Like, obviously, he's like the heavy hitter. As it turns out, he's like the one guy you really needed, right? Like, he's the only guy that really is able to do something at the end of the day, I guess, besides, yeah, like Harley Quinn, who's like too smart for Enchantress, who's all powerful. But beyond that, yeah, like, it's just the whole thing about kind of his backstory. I think that was part of the problem is that we tried to rush too many people's backstories. Like, this idea of how he killed his wife and burned down the whole house, but then her body's not burned down, but then he has a dream. And, like, or no, in Enchantress's vision, like, that he's envisioning, like, the kids being asleep so he can spend time with his wife.
Yeah, Enchantress tries to basically pull a Scarlet Witch. And again, I apologize for the Marvel comparison, but I think she tries to, like, provide them with their happiest memory or their happiest ideal future so that they get caught up in that. And I'll admit, I did like going along with our Joker and Harley praise. I did love her, you know, utopian goal with him is to live in a white picket fence household. And he had no makeup and he was just regular Jared Leto with these kids.
Oh, see, we have a disagreement we're going to get to on that one in a second.
Okay.
Kevin does not think that's Harley's fundamental aim, right?
Yeah, like before I jump into that though, I do want to say the El Diablo thing was weird to me. I thought the story was with him was good, but there's a scene where his wife comes down and like has all the money and the guns and is just kind of like, "What is it that you do? You know, you do bad things, blah blah blah." And I'm like, "Have you looked at him? Do you think he worked at Best Buy? Like, what did you think was happening here?" It was just such a weird, like, obviously he's doing bad things, you know. But as for the Joker and Harley thing, this is another thing of like that missing the fundamental stuff about these characters, like, and about what this movie should have been. That scene, in my humble opinion, should have been they're seeing their visions. You should have seen, first of all, Deadshot with his daughter not killing Batman. Why is that your fantasy, Deadshot? When did that become your goal?
Yeah, you passed up on that.
Yeah,
you had
like
that
it's just
shot.
It made no sense to have him have that vision. So it should have been him with his daughter. You could have had El Diablo with his family. You could have had all these people, like Katana with her husband, whatever. Like, all these people have their own individual goals, and you could have shown them. And then the last one you cut to, after seeing all these happy, like, typical moments, you see Harley and Joker laughing maniacally as they're just shooting or murdering people, because that's what they are. And it would have been this a really funny break from this perfect stuff that everyone else envisioning to their psychotic life, and it would have been the like exactly what she should have been imagining, and it would have been humor. And I'm like, this is what it should have been. Why, how did you guys not see that? And it was just, yeah, so like that's my issue with that scene, is that why does Harley want that? Like, when did that become a thing? So yeah, it was just yeah.
The thing about El Diablo for me with the fire powers, and I guess speaking more so towards the general superpowers that are used in this film, I don't know, I feel like there might have been some power in telling, not showing, for a good portion of it. Like when you have Amanda Waller tell him, like, "Hey, we saw you take out an entire prison yard during a riot with your fire." I feel like you don't necessarily need to show it. I feel like there'd be a lot of dramatic tension if you just kept talking about his power and he decided not to use it. He decided, like, "I'm literally a ticking time bomb. Let me just reserve myself and not use anything." So that the first time when he really does use that to burn everybody in that building, that becomes a much more weighted moment. I feel like when he did do it, it was great, but we had already seen him use those powers, so it didn't really hold as much dramatic heft as they wanted it to.
Yeah, that's a great point. The show don't tell element. Yeah, we saw that scene of him roasting the prison yard like three different times on different, tablets and stuff. So yeah, I think that was a bit overkill. And it actually brings me back to the point I wanted to make and forgot about between Rick Flagg and Enchantress, was just they break a fundamental, to me, a fundamental rule of storytelling in general, which is the audience knew about this relationship from the beginning. You don't show the reveal to the team when it's not a reveal to the audience. You just have him say, like, "All right, guys, we should talk," and then just move on and do something else. And when you come back, it's assumed that they're caught up to where we already are. I think explaining something we already know is a huge, huge just error in terms of what you're
also
trying to
showing
do.
showing a flashback from the movie we just saw. Like, they flashback in the movie with Enchantress to a scene we saw 45 minutes ago. And it's like, why are you re-showing this to us? We just saw it happen. It was so weird.
And I think that speaks to, right, like, and I hate to say it, because again, I've always preferred DC to Marvel, but Marvel doesn't do that. They if you can err on the side of giving too much or giving too little, they decide to give too little and decide, if you're confused, you can go look it up afterwards. I think DC tends to err on the side of like, well, we need to explain this because it still might not be clear to a few people in the room.
We need to show Batman's parents getting murdered every time in case people don't know that.
Just in case, no, if you've been living under a rock and you came only to the movie theater and you had no idea who Batman was or what his origin story is, we need to make sure we reach out to that one person so that they know what happened.
But at the same time, we're going to usk over the fact that a Robin was murdered. But yeah, we're going to re-show you that. Like something you've never experienced on live cinema before ever, but we're gonna, I mean, it's just a few creative decisions I think along the way that make you scratch your head. And it is a shame because I think there's a lot of elements here, you know, and, you know, one I've mentioned a couple times, I think Viola Davis as Amanda Waller is probably for me the best casting of the whole movie. I think she's perfect in what she's asked to do. I hate that she's asked to kill those FBI guys. And I feel like there could be more like true Amanda Waller moments where she's like in Captain Boomerang's ear and telling him to like put down Deadshot if he, you know, does something like this, and she'll give him like 50 years off his sentence. Like, that's the kind of thing Amanda Waller can do. She can like subvert the team with individual direction. I wish we'd seen some more of that, but in terms of what Viola Davis did, I thought it was really awesome.
I'd agree. And I think one of the problems I actually do have with Marvel films are that I feel like there is an inundation of having the big bad ultimately be some guy in a suit, and to have it be like, oh, it wasn't this supervillain, it was the guy at the desk who was doing it the entire time and pulling the strings. And Suicide Squad, even though we didn't see a lot of Enchantress and Incubus specifically in that middle portion of the film, they at least didn't go in that direction. Yes, as you said, Alex, Amanda Waller is can be very manipulative in turning people against each other for her own will, but it's not like they have to face down Amanda Waller in the end, which I was happy about, because I do feel like that is a trope that Marvel has bought into maybe one too many times in the past few years.
Yeah, I can definitely agree with that. Like, most of Marvel's villains are also forgettable. There's few and far between. Like, Kingpin is phenomenal, but he is also technically a guy in a suit. Loki, of course, is the standout, and he's a bit different. And I feel like for all the good Marvel does, they do have a villain problem. That all said, I mean, I know people hate the comparisons we make between Marvel and DC, but I feel like these comparisons, these are the ones you have to do. And at the end of the day, I think a big issue is that, as we've kind of said, Marvel gets the characters. Marvel gets the fundamental, you know, natures of the characters and what they do and what they stand for, with little things. Whereas DC or Warner Brothers has been missing that, like the little moments with Harley where it's like off, or like Amanda Waller where it's off, where it's like they're missing that actual comic book writer, like that hardcore comic book voice. And Marvel definitely has it. Marvel has people who work on the comics who are very involved in that stuff, or at least get talked to, and the cast reads the comics. I feel like Warner Brothers has kind of shut that down, you know?
Mm-hmm. So let's touch upon a few other members of the squad that we really haven't discussed too much. Let's talk about Killer Croc, played by, I'm just going to say Mr. Echo, because that's what he's most well known for, and I cannot for the life of me pronounce his name. Alex, did Killer Croc make an impression on you, aside from his skin impressions from his birth condition?
I get what they were going for. You know, a lot of times when you include a Killer Croc, or in some cases a King Shark or a KG Beast or one of these guys in a Suicide Squad, they're going to be your big muscle element that also has very little to say. But then usually on these teams, when they do talk, they say something like unexpectedly funny. So they do provide some element of comic relief. And that's definitely what they were going for here. I think one problem was that he was a bit hard to understand in general. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of the lines that he delivered, I was like, wait, did I hear that right? I had to like replay it in my head a bit. Like, oh, I'm beautiful. Right. I got it. Like, there was just a couple, and it almost became too much, I think, also. But, like, obviously, like, I get the presence. I get why he's there. But Killer Croc, Waylon Jones, like, this is one of my, and it's weird because nobody shares this opinion, this is one of my favorite comic characters, one of my favorite Batman villains. I love this character. And so it wasn't my favorite. It wasn't, like, the best adaptation, I think, as good as it could have been. But it definitely had some elements of the core character.
Mm-hmm. Kevin, did Killer Croc snap for you?
Yeah, I kind of felt the same way. It sucks because he could have been utilized in such a great way, like a Batman flashback, because he's a Batman villain. But yeah, it was just, he was there again just to be another scaly face in the crowd, I guess, like, because he didn't leave that much of an impression. The only really thing I remember from him was where he did that weird crocodile scuttle into the water at one point when he was going diving, which was just kind of a comedic scene, and I don't know if it was supposed to be, because he did that like weird, you know, I grew up in Florida a little bit, so I saw a lot of, you know, things like, you know, them scuttling into the water, so I was like, that's spot on. I don't know if they should have made him do that, but that's how that looks. And that's like that's the scene that I remember, which is weird that that's the scene that Killer Croc has to stand out in.
Mm-hmm. Captain Boomerang, we spoke about him before. Jai Courtney, he sort of served as, I feel like, the constant comic relief throughout this. I mean, he is, as David Ayer kind of puts it to Jai Courtney when they first get together, a shit bag. He definitely is. He's a thief. He definitely tries to bail out from minute one. Kevin, did he work for you as either a source of comic relief or just as a character in general? Did you want more Captain Boomerang?
100%. 100% wanted more Captain Boomerang. I thought he provided, like, the main comic relief in the movie to me that I genuinely liked. I liked that we saw the Flash for all of 5 seconds, but still pretty cool that they, you know, acknowledge the fact that he's a Flash villain. So, like, that was really awesome. I mean, you know, Arrow has, the Arrow Flash universe of the TV has used him before, which was really cool. And I know he's been missing for a while because there's a weird Warner Brothers movie TV situation where they don't want them both being used, which kind of sucks because I think he is a great character and can be utilized more in both aspects. He should have been utilized more in the movie and more in the TV show too.
Mm-hmm. Alex, do you think that Captain Boomerang, while funny, might have been one of the least used members of the team? Because I'm trying to think about, like, this final fight, right, where everyone is using their own superpower. You know, Harley is the one to defeat Enchantress. Killer Croc swims underneath and gets Incubus blown up. El Diablo sacrifices himself for Incubus. Deadshot obviously makes the shot. Captain Boomerang throws a radio-operated boomerang with a camera on it? Do you think that maybe one of the reasons why there wasn't enough Captain Boomerang in this movie was because his powers are kind of pale in comparison to what everyone else brings to the table?
Well, I'm a little frustrated by that because I like Captain Boomerang, and I'm going to go to bat for him here. I think he can do more than what they showed. I think one element of Captain Boomerang that's so cool is, like, you know, we talked about the Harley Quinn and Black Widow comparison, how they kind of, you know, they're two people, they're the females on the team, they don't have powers, there's a lot of comparisons there. To me, Captain Boomerang is very much like the Hawkeye, where, like, Hawkeye has all these trick arrows. He has all these different kinds of arrows with different kinds of abilities, and you see them coming up in a lot of different ways in the Avengers films. Like, he's got one with a USB on it that scrambles the entire jet, and he's got one that, you know, I mean, he's got so many different kinds of, you know, arrows in his arsenal, and Captain Boomerang, you know, really should be the same way. And I think it is a bit of an issue that we only saw, like, one, yeah, like, RC Boomerang and like, the ones with blades on them. But there's, you know, there's a lot more that he can do there. And he's not useless without him either. Like, he can throw lots of things and take people out. You know, he's capable with anything that's Boomerang-esque. So I think that was, you know, something that was maybe missing. It's like, just, you know, the guy is not feeble when it comes to a fight. But yeah, the comedic element is definitely his presence. Like, he's always going to be there. And I wish I'd seen more of it, too, where, you know, he's undermining Will Smith's leadership for everything he does. Like, well, I would have done something different. You know, like, always playing Captain Hindsight, where he's hitting on Harley Quinn and she doesn't like it. Like, that's really when he's at his best on these teams.
I will say, as much as we may mourn the lack of Captain Boomerang in this film, I have a hunch that he's coming back. Just a hunch. So I do want to finish off our character talk by talking about someone who might have been gone a little too soon. Alex spoke about him a little bit. Let's talk about Slipknot, the red shirt, or the red rope, I guess, of this film. Kevin, talk to me a little bit about Slipknot's general part in the original Suicide Squad. Was it appropriate to have him get killed off so early in this iteration?
I mean, if there's going to be someone, he might as well be the one, because I'll be honest, I barely know much about Slipknot to begin with. I know more about the band Slipknot than I do.
I know, between, like, Slipknot and Incubus, I guess so many bands were just ahead of their time taking their names from characters in this film.
Yeah, totally. It's such a weird thing. Like, he's a guy who's very good at scaling stuff. You know, he's like a climber and things like that, and a burglar. But, like, yeah, he's not a prominent comic book character. So it was really funny when they did the whole showing these characters thing, and it's kind of like, okay, so Slipknot's definitely getting his head blown off. You know, like, you could tell that was coming, as Alec kind of mentioned earlier.
And I think that's a thing, too, where, you know, me and Kevin, you know, definitely knew something like that was coming. That is a commonality in pretty much any time a Suicide Squad is introduced and Amanda Waller makes clear the situation with the nanotechnology in the back of your neck that can explode you. Pretty much someone has to be made an example of. Someone's going to test it. and just to, you know, showcase that someone's head is getting blown off. Like, that rings true pretty much every time. So I went into this movie not wondering if, but wondering when and who it was going to be the one to test the tech. And sure enough, as Slipknot is the one to roll up after all the backstories are revealed, I think it was the writing was on the wall.
Yeah. To answer your questions, the who is Slipknot and the when is about, what, 3 minutes in? Which, again, like, if you, I guess looking back retroactively, it does make sense. I was so alarmed when he first got brought up because I was like, first of all, I was a little confused as to why, I guess Captain Boomerang, since he's more of a Flash villain, was jailed separately from everyone else because he wasn't part of the initial big sequence where they went to everyone in the prison in Louisiana and then they put the tags in them. They just sort of had him in a literal bag of boomerangs, and they just kind of threw him out into the brush in a way. And then Slipknot just kind of happens to show up as well, and it turns out that these two are the ones that make a break for it, and one of them suffers the consequences. But that being said, I guess they sort of like circled and underlined it a bit by saying like, hey, yeah, you don't know a lot about him and you're not going to need to, because his head's going to get blown off, presumably off camera.
And you touched on an element I think that I wish I had seen a little bit more of explored too. And I guess, you know, Kevin makes a good point that, you know, the more you get into kind of the government elements and the kind of, you know, secret agencies and this stuff, you really are getting into S.H.I.E.L.D. and you do want to create an identity that's separate from Marvel. But at the same time, I really wish they had talked about how Amanda Waller is the director of Argus and, you know, just the element of Argus and how this is like an off the books type of thing that, you know about the CIA and you know about the FBI, but you don't know about Argus and, you know, what happens to these villains after Batman and these people catch them. It's like, well, it turns out, yeah, they go completely away. And, you know, I think, you know, we talked about it a little bit at the beginning, but, you know, I came away thinking like, oh, well, she works for the government. And it could have been, I don't know, there was a way I think that it could have been expressed more clearly that she's kind of like in this kind of secret role that's operating, you know, with government authority, but at the same time, she's kind of able to do her own thing and get away with it.
As someone who just watched all of the Bourne franchise a couple of weeks ago, I can completely agree that the moments that really confuse me in that series are when they're like, we're with the CIA, but we're also part of this secret program called Treadstone or Blackbriar or whatever you'd like to call it, where, yeah, once it's not really delineated out or there's too much going on with that organization, things can very much muddy the water. And yeah, I had no idea what Argus was outside of the caretaker of Hogwarts after you just mentioned that name. So I would have liked some more information about it. Though again, they love to set up their sequels, so maybe it is possible. Do you have any other thoughts about specific characters before we jump into some more general questions from our listening audience?
Not a lot that comes to mind. I think we hit all the characters, right? That's how bad it is, right? That we're here like, is there anyone we missed because they just didn't have enough screen time for us to remember?
What about, did you like Common's cameo as one of the Joker's associates?
Oh, what? I didn't even know that.
I did catch that. Yeah, apparently his henchman name was Monster T. So there you go. Common as Monster
T. I hope that
T.
means that I hope that means his superpower was that he turned into a monster truck.
or Mr. T.
Yeah, monstrous
or
Mr.
Mr.
T.
Or Mr. T.
There was also Scott Eastwood was in this movie.
Yeah.
Clint Eastwood's son, which was there another character where it's just like, oh, yeah, they're the guys that work with Red Flag and he's going to be used to like set off the bomb, which was another like weird thing. Like, why did that bomb also work on Incubus? Like, he got like a train hit him and didn't kill him. What was up with that bomb that was so specific? It was very weird, that scene, too.
Yeah, and I don't know. Did Scott Eastwood die then? I was waiting for him
to die the entire time.
Oh, yeah, he exploded
with that bomb.
Well, good for him. I mean, Scott Eastwood, I guess, might be one of the true GQ Edwards. I'm looking at his name right now. Might be one of the true heroes of this movie because he didn't have to like mull it over. I'm sure he had a family to go back to, but no, he sacrificed himself to make sure this magical creature went down.
Yeah, that's very accurate. He's the most heroic in the entire film.
but again, like not to beat the dead horse, but I mean, this is why you use the Suicide Squad. It's so GQ Edwards doesn't have to lay his life on the line. You know, like the whole fundamental premise of what the Suicide Squad is about is that you don't want to waste your GQ Edwards. So you make Killer Croc go do that thing.
Yeah, fundamental miss on what they do.
So I have a lot of questions from our listening audience at post-show recaps. I ask for questions on Twitter, Facebook, what have you. We answered a bunch of them, but I want to touch on a few more as we're finishing things up here. Philip Tostado asked, how unconvincing slash out of character was Harley's "You Hurt My Friends" speech? Now, for those of you that might not have remembered, this is the very end when Harley decides to face off against Enchantress, and she decides to call the Suicide Squad her friends. I believe even El Diablo refers to them as like a family.
I won't let you kill my other family. Yeah.
Yeah, earlier on in the film as well. Kevin, do you think those words were... do you think they were appropriate? Or do you think that these... do you think these guys became a little too close a little too quickly to warrant those types of statements?
I mean, I think they definitely came a little too close a little too quickly, especially since this was, like, their first mission. They honestly should have done an establishing mission at the beginning of this movie before going into the big mission at the end, just to help establish the relationship just by virtue of perceived experience. So, yeah, when she's like, "You hurt my friends," it's like, what? Also, when she came back to them after the Joker crashed, like, why did she go back? Like, I guess she was just like, well, I got nothing else to do. Like, so it was really weird.
I think she actually literally said that when they walked by and she was sitting on the hood of the car. She's like, oh, I got nothing else to do.
Yeah, that's just, it's so weird. So yeah, it didn't feel fully earned.
Alex, do you feel like that speech represented some sort of change in the character or sense set of characters? And if so, was it warranted at all?
I mean, it was weird. And I think if I want to give it a pass, I'll make the argument that, like, okay, well, Harley Quinn's obviously stalling and she's trying to, you know, make a play at Enchantress. But I think really then you can poke a hole at the fact that, like, well, Enchantress has this world engine in place that is going to be, like, active and unstoppable in like 30 seconds. Like, why doesn't she just warp to, like, you know, somewhere far away until it's ready to go so that she's not vulnerable? So, you know, to me, it was more like, I can almost give the speech a pass just because of, like, it's ultimately a means to an end. And, you know, maybe she's just, you know, making up whatever she can think of. But then, you know, the fact that Enchantress is letting the girl with the baseball bat take her down, I think that I had a harder time with that.
So we spoke earlier about a standalone Harley Quinn movie. Benji Glowinski asks, based on how they did in Suicide Squad, which of these characters do you most want to see a spinoff movie of? Kevin, any thoughts? It can be Harley if you want to, but were there any characters that stuck out so much or you wanted to see more of them in another spinoff film?
Like, do you mean like as not the main character or as their own film?
I guess we'll, for the sake of brevity, we'll go with as a main character.
Oh boy. I guess Amanda Waller, like, actually just on her own would actually be an interesting film to see what she, like, almost like the weird, like, the business of superheroes film of, like, seeing her interact with the DC universe as a whole. Yeah, she'll be with the Suicide Squad, but you also see scenes like her and Batman at the post-credit scene. Like, things like that would actually be kind of fascinating to me to see, is, like, that perspective of how does Argus react to these superheroes and what they do. I think I would actually very much enjoy that. I would honestly like to see Joker and Harley in a Batman movie. I don't necessarily want to see a Joker and Harley-centric film, though.
Mm-hmm. Alex, any characters for you that you would want to see helming their own film?
I like Kevin's idea about Amanda Waller. That, yeah, it's like a Frank Underwood style rise to power. That would be kind of cool. And yeah, obviously, I think Joker and Harley, like, it needs to be explored further. The Joker character, very little screen time. But then, I mean, once you get past that, it's hard to see, because the backstory is there for some of these characters. They just didn't come off as someone that really needs to be explored, or, you know, or really as even someone that could carry their own movie. I think I could see Will Smith as Deadshot in a feature film and making that work. I think, you know, you need to spend less time with the, you know, like, maybe just have him look, like I said, look at the picture of the daughter, less time actually, like, listening to the little girl having qualms with him hurting people, and more time of him just kind of, like, just, you know, being the world's greatest assassin, going out and, like that scene where he, you know, he has the hit and he's got the 10-second window and he's insisting the guy give him the million and then, all right, double it for being a dick. Like, that was fantastic. That's true Deadshot. So if there's a lot more of that, like, I could definitely go for a Will Smith Deadshot movie.
What would be the better title? Amanda Waller in House of Cads or Deadshot in Dadshot?
Oh, man.
Coming this fall. You can imagine, like, the goofy music they use for the Suicide Squad trailers.
Yeah, like, what's that movie where The Rock has, like, the little girl come live with him and then he's, like, wearing the tutu?
Oh gosh, that's not Tooth Fairy, which I believe he was also
no,
in.
No, which that was where he becomes the Tooth Fairy. Right.
Yeah, no, he's like a successful football player until his daughter is dropped at his door.
Yeah. Let's take this opportunity to actually talk a little bit about what's to come in the DC Extended Universe. At Comic-Con, which happened a couple weeks before this movie dropped, we saw trailers for Justice League and for Wonder Woman. Kevin, what are your thoughts about these two films, both from their trailer and in comparison to what we just experienced with both Batman versus Superman and Suicide Squad?
Well, it's really tough because, like, I'm actually really pumped for Wonder Woman, especially after that trailer. I thought the trailer was phenomenal. So I'm actually really, really excited for it. This movie has tempered it somewhat. I'm hoping that, obviously, there's just going to be a huge disconnect between the bigger, I guess, the bigger studios and Zack Snyder influence on it. So Wonder Woman seems like it's its own entity, and I think that gives it a lot of hope of being, like, really, really fantastic. So I'm really excited about that. There's just so much in that Wonder Woman trailer I really liked, like, from Steve Trevor to, like, seeing the lasso in use. I'm actually really pumped for Wonder Woman.
What about Justice League? Any sort of impression from that?
Yeah, so Justice League is a weird one, right? Like, I thought the trailer did what it needed to do, which I hope is not lie to audiences, but, like, it had great elements of humor. Like, I thought everything happening with the Flash was amazing. Ezra Miller as Barry Allen, but in actuality, Bart Allen, if I had to actually put a guess on who he's playing, because, like, he basically didn't have Barry's personality. He had the personality of another Flash from some comic book stuff right there. But I loved it. I loved his humor. I loved his mannerisms. I loved the things he said. I thought that was really great. I'm not 100% on Batman cracking a lot of jokes. Like, I think Batman every now and then is allowed to crack a joke. But it's just weird where you're just like, we need Batman to even crack jokes now. And I'm like, okay, that's a little out of character. But there was a lot to really like about that Justice League trailer. But I have a lot of hesitation because of the higher people involved, like Zack Snyder and stuff. It's still a Zack Snyder movie, and he did BVS and Man of Steel. So it's like my excitement for Justice League is nowhere near 11 as my excitement for Wonder Woman.
Alex, you talked before about how going into Suicide Squad, you tried to keep your expectations to a minimum. Like Kevin, are you pumped beyond belief from these trailers? Are you still trying to, like, temper down your feelings after seeing Batman versus Superman and Suicide Squad and not really overly enjoying both of them?
Yeah, honestly, I'm not even trying anymore. Like, it's just they're tempered without effort now.
You died inside.
It's been a gradual descent, and yeah, I'm waiting for the film to come along and kind of, like, reinvigorate my love in characters that I've loved for so many years. You know, I've been a bit frustrated, like, to be perfectly honest. So yeah, I'm still waiting for that moment. I think Kevin articulated it very well, and I think, you know, yeah, like, if you really get these characters, you know that Batman is the moment where Batman is funny is when he's unintentionally funny, when he's so deadpan serious in a moment that's funny that you're like, oh, Batman, you know what I mean? Like, that's so I think there's just some kind of disconnect that, you know, it could totally click in the next movie or the one after, and I'm totally back on board. But yeah, I think you got to get me back. I'm not there right now.
Matthew Murphy kind of postulates a what if from the next couple of DC films. If Wonder Woman bombs, is there any hope for the DCEU? Kevin, could we possibly see a form of a backzit from the extended universe in a way where if Wonder Woman and Justice League do not do well, Warner Brothers is basically going to try to kind of take out the entire franchise and maybe try to build it again from the ground up?
Oh my gosh, I wouldn't be surprised. I hope they don't do it too quickly. I mean, they just have trouble. I think my personal opinion, if this does not go well, Crisis on Infinite Earths, which is a mega event from the comic books, which involves parallel realities, have the TV universe come in and save the day and have the TV universe be the stars. Because honestly, the DC TV universe kicks major butt. The Flash is incredible. Yeah. Arrow has its ups and downs. Legends of Tomorrow is a lot of fun. I'm really excited for the second season. And now Supergirl's on there? Supergirl is great. Like, the actress, I think, does such a good job of portraying Supergirl, and now they're going to have a Superman in that universe, and that Superman, to me, actually might be Superman. Like, Henry Cavill, you know, bless his heart, was not very Superman-like in either of the movies, but the TV universe is nailing it, and they have a grasp on these characters, and I think if it all goes badly, give it to those guys. Those guys know what they're doing. They know the characters. They've been doing the thing that we've been criticizing the movies for. And I think that's the best way to do it. I think they should just Crisis on Infinite Earths it and have the TV universe become its main movie universe.
Well, and one thing I will say is that I am looking forward to seeing what this alternate version of this movie looks like and kind of what that was, because I've always maintained that I think a big part of their issue is that they're reacting more than they are just creating and letting the work speak for themselves, which is really how you make good art, I think. And you see, like, I think in a lot of cases with these movies, I think you're seeing there's too many cooks in the kitchen. I think there's too many people with too many visions. And that's a problem when you're connecting one movie to another in an extended universe.
I mean, it's not only too many cooks, it's the cooks are making their meal while at the same time turning another eye at what's going on in the restaurant next door and saying, like, oh, we need to make meals like they are. I think I completely agree. I think their problem is that they feel like they're trying to play catch up. As a result, you get sort of the equivalent of what we just got with the Suicide Squad, where it's like, great, let's bring in 9 people. We have to introduce their backstories. We have to create relationships. We have to make an action-packed movie and encapsulate all these elements into a little under 2.5 hours. It's a recipe for failure. I almost feel like they should be taking baby steps when instead they're using stilts, you know? They need to be saying, like, let's start building basics from the beginning. Let's make sure everyone's on board with our Superman, with our Batman. And maybe this Batman standalone film and Wonder Woman are going to be good examples of them kind of doing that, of them saying, let's go back to our roots and make sure our audiences get behind these characters in the first place. I don't think it's any coincidence that their most well-known franchise of Christopher Nolan's Batman started from the beginning and worked his way through his entire superhero career, basically. So we followed this man from day one to his retirement day. And I feel like you need to do that with these types of franchises. And I guess sort of speaking more so towards my feelings of how that ties into Suicide Squad, as we sort of segue into our final thoughts here, I think there were some really good elements. There were inklings of a lot of good stuff going on. As I've echoed many times before, the performances pretty much across the board were great. I appreciated the fact that they were trying to at least go for more lighthearted performances. That there were so many Captain Boomerang moments attempted in there, or Will Smith remarks, that it made it a more enjoyable experience overall, and that they attempted to make it more of a chaotic thing than a lawful thing, as these other Batman and Superman films have been doing. That being said, again, it's another example of them needing to crawl before they could walk. There were just so many elements of basic filmmaking that were not present or were done wrong in this film. And as a result, I could not put myself past that. So again, while I did enjoy it more than Batman versus Superman personally, it still was not a good film in my book. Alex, final thoughts on Suicide Squad?
No, yeah, I think you summed it up very well. I think we've hit on a lot of the points. I think this is a movie that I came in really trying to give every benefit of the doubt, as I said, and I ultimately left frustrated. Like I said, I did enjoy it more than BVS, but that really is damning with faint praise. I don't want that to be the standard that I'm holding DC films to, because I know how good these characters are. I know how good these stories can be. And yeah, I do have high expectations because of what I've been exposed to in the past. So whether or not it's fair, it is. And, you know, moving forward, we'll see what we get, and I'm looking forward to it. But I have definitely been gradually tempering my expectations as I go. But again, I've touched it on a few times. I think some of the animated films that DC is creating right now are fantastic. So it's an interesting dichotomy.
Kevin, as our comic book expert, you, like Amanda Waller and Batman in the mid-credits scene of this film, get the last word. What are your overall thoughts about Suicide Squad?
I feel like Suicide Squad is the movie of what could have been. I feel like it had a lot of potential, as we all stated. I think you guys kind of expressed perfectly the same feeling as I had about how, you know, it could have been so much better than it was. They were way too reactionary, which caused problems. I will say, though, I think even before the whole, you know, they should try to crawl before they can run even, I think if they really want to succeed, my best advice is, guys, read the comics. Like, find out, like, legit find out. Because, like, they try to make these characters into something they're not. They, when you try to react, the characters become not who they are. People, like, you know, Alex said, like, I've loved these characters since I was a kid. So was he. There's a reason so many of us love these characters. And it's not because of a recent thing. It's something about who these characters are and what they represent. And even if they don't think that's quote-unquote cool or edgy, people still love them for that reason. And they need to read the comics, understand who these characters are, then make these movies. That is the quintessential thing Marvel keeps getting right, especially about their heroes, that DC, I think Warner Brothers, is missing. And even with their villains in this movie of Suicide Squad, they missed a fundamental stuff. And I feel like that sadly affected the movie. And yeah, I don't want the standard to be like, well, it was better than Batman versus Superman, I guess. But even if it's better than Batman versus Superman, the comparison will be made. It's still worse than almost every Marvel movie. So, guys, get with it. We're begging you.
All right, guys, I want to thank you so much for coming on to talk to me about this, especially as someone who personally does not know too much about the Suicide Squad's background, specifically from the comics. It was great for me to get some insight into that and to just hear your general thoughts about the movie and how it compares. Let's go down the line. If you guys want to give out your Twitter handles and talk a little bit about what you're doing on post-show recaps or in the RHAP universe and what might be coming up for you soon. Let's go back to Kevin.
So I got coming up, I think I will be doing, Josh and I should be doing Luke Cage, which is going to be premiering soon. The plan is hopefully for us to do that. So I'm pretty excited about it. I've done previous ones.
Unbreakable coverage from you guys.
Yes. Unbreakable Luke Schmidt. So we got that. We're planning on hoping to get done and coming up. Previous ones, of course, Daredevil, Jessica Jones. We did them a couple Marvel Avengers movies. But yeah, other than that, I got loot crates coming out, so if anybody's interested in loot crates, you should sign up. We've got some Harley Quinn items this month.
Will include a dead pig and use condoms as well to fully simulate the Suicide Squad experience?
No, we did not condone such things over at Loot Crate.
What about Enchantress's heart?
Yeah, there we go. You'll get to control your own 6,000-year-old deity, and nothing will go wrong with that plan.
Perfect. And follow Kevin on Twitter. He is at Kev Mahadeo, M-A-H-A-D-E-O. Alex Kidwell, where can we find you and what do you have coming up?
Okay, so yeah, right now I'm just fully immersed in Big Brother coverage over at Rob Has a Podcast that is taking over my summer, and it seems will be taking over my fall because they're jumping right into another season right after that. So that's a lot of what I'm doing right now. Also, Fear the Walking Dead coming back in not too long, and me and Rob have been covering that because Josh has a lot on his plate right now. And Fear the Walking Dead not exactly been drawing the rave reviews. It hasn't been as exciting as maybe we'd like, but hopefully season two pick up and we'll take it from there. And I'm at Alex Kidwell on Twitter.
All right. You can find me, as always, at a Mike Bloom type on Twitter, as I mentioned before. If you want to listen to me talk some more about summer movies, I got together with the aforementioned Josh Wiggler to talk about Jason Bourne, the latest release of the Bourne movie series that came out last week. Also, check out our other summer movie coverage of Ghostbusters and Star Trek Beyond. I know the Lost Lives franchise will be coming back very, very soon with a few podcasts, and this might not be the last time you hear my voice in the next few weeks. And other than that, as Alex said, we have some fall TV coming up. Fear of the Walking Dead, Walking Dead proper is coming back as well. Once Upon a Time, as Kevin mentioned, Luke Cage is coming back. So please make sure you stay subscribed to Post Show Recap. Go to postshowrecaps.com/iTunes. We have some other great non-movie stuff going on right now. Stellar coverage of Mr. Robot with Josh Wiggler and Antonio Mazzaro, and I'm actually going to be pinch hitting for Josh on that podcast for the next 2 weeks, and I'm super pumped to do that. And of course, the Seinfeld coverage going on as always. Gentlemen, again, thank you so much for coming on. To finish off, we need a hashtag. How do you guys feel about Dad Shot?
Yes, I love Dad Shot.
I like it.
all right, we'll put out the idea, just like The Secret, into the universe that we want this standalone Deadshot family life Will Smith movie to happen. It's like The Pursuit of Happiness, but grittier and with Bohemian Rhapsody playing in the background. So hashtag Dadshot if you made it this far. Thank you guys so much for listening. Let us know your thoughts about Suicide Squad as well. It was a big tentpole movie, as Kevin said, made the most amount of money for any August opening ever, which is definitely nothing to sneeze at. So please, if you've seen the movie, or if you haven't, if you just listened to 2+ hours of this, let us know your thoughts. But for now, I have a date with Amanda Waller and a nice piece of steak. So take care, everyone. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Just killed a man, put a gun against his head, pulled my trigger now.